Sonnet, 19:9. Alone today, I mounted that steep hill on which the Wartburg stands. Here Luther dwelt in these close walls a year through. Here he spelt the German Bible out by God's good will. The birds piped tit tit too, and as I went, I thought how Catherine von Bora knelt at Grima, idle she, waiting to melt her surpliced heart in folds less straitly meant. As now, it was March then. Lo, he'll fulfill today his mighty task. Sing for content, ye birds, pipe now, for now 'tis love's wings bent. Work sleeps, love wakes, sing, and the glad air thrill. The next title is Patterson, The Falls. What common language to unravel? The falls, combed into straight lines from that rafter of a rock's lip, strike in, the middle of some trenchant phrase, some well-packed clause. Then, this is my plan. Four sections. First, the archaic persons of the drama. An eternity of bird and bush resolved, an unraveling. The confused streams aligned, side by side, speaking. Sound married to strength, the strength of falling from a height. The wild voice of the shirt-sleeved evangelist rivaling. Hear me! I am the resurrection and the life, echoing among the bass and pickerel, slim eels from Barbados, Sargasso Sea, working up the coast to that bounty, ponds and wild streams. Third, the old town. Alexander Hamilton working up from St. Croix, from that sea and the deeper whence he came, stopped cold by that unmoving roar, fastened there, the rocks silent, but the water, married to the stone, voluble, though frozen. The water, even when and though frozen, still whispers and moans. And in the brittle air, a factory bell clangs at dawn, and snow whines under their feet. Fourth, the modern town, a disembodied roar, the cataract and its clamor broken apart, and from all learning, the empty ear struck from within, roaring. Peace on Earth. The archer is wake, the swan is flying, gold against blue an arrow is lying, there is hunting in heaven, sleep safe till tomorrow. The bears are abroad, the eagle is screaming, gold against blue their eyes are gleaming, sleep, sleep safe till tomorrow. The sisters lie with their arms intertwining, gold against blue their hair is shining. The serpent writhes, Orion is listening. Gold against blue his sword is glistening. Sleep, there is hunting in heaven. Sleep safe till tomorrow. Title, Postlude. Now that I have cooled to you, let there be gold of tarnished masonry, temples soothed by the sun to ruin that sleep utterly. Give me hand for the dances, ripples at Phyle in and out, and lips, my lesbian, wallflowers that once were flame. Your hair is my Carthage and my arms the bow, and our words arrows that shoot the stars who from that misty sea swarm to destroy us. But you there beside me, oh, how shall I defy you who wound me in the night with breasts shining like Venus and like Mars? The night that is shouting Jason when the loud eaves rattle as with waves above me blue at the prow of my desire. O prayers in the dark, O incense to Poseidon, calm in Atlantis. Pastoral. When I was younger, it was plain to me I must make something of myself. Older now, I walk back streets, admiring the houses of the very poor, roof out of line with sides, the yards cluttered with old chicken wire, ashes, furniture gone wrong, the fences and outhouses built of barrel staves and parts of boxes, all, if I'm fortunate, smeared a bluish green that, properly weathered, pleases me best of all colors. No one will believe this of vast import to the nation. Pastoral again. The little sparrows hop ingenuously about the pavement, quarreling with sharp voices over those things that interest them. But we who are wiser shut ourselves in on either hand, and no one knows whether we think good or evil. Meanwhile, the old man who goes about gathering dog lime walks in the gutter without looking up, and his tread is more majestic than that of the Episcopal minister approaching the pulpit of a Sunday. These things astonish me beyond words. Titled Dawn. Ecstatic bird songs pound the hollow vastness of the sky with metallic clinkings, beating color up into it at a far edge, beating it with rising triumphant ardor, stirring it into warmth, quickening in it a spreading change, bursting wildly against it, as dividing the horizon, a heavy sun lifts himself, is lifted, bit by bit above the edge of things, runs free at last, out into the open, lumbering, glorified in full release, upward, songs cease. Portrait of a Woman in Bed. There's my things, drying in the corner, that blue skirt joined to the gray shirt. I'm sick of trouble. Lift the covers if you want me, and you'll see the rest of my clothes, though it'd be cold lying here with nothing on. I won't work, and I've no cash. What are you going to do about it? And no jewelry, the crazy fools. But I've my two eyes and a smooth face, and here's this. Look, it's high. There's brains and blood in there. My name's Robitza. Corsets can go to the devil, and the rest along with them. What do I care? My two boys, they're keen. Let the rich lady care for them. They'll beat the school. Oh, let them go to the gutter. That ends trouble. This house is empty, isn't it? Then it's mine, because I need it. Oh, I won't starve while there's the Bible to make them feed me. Try to help me if you want trouble, or leave me alone. That ends trouble. The county physician is a damn fool, and you can go to hell. You could have closed the door when you came in. Do it when you go out. I'm tired. Sympathetic portrait of a child. The murderer's little daughter, who is barely 10 years old, jerks her shoulders right and left so as to catch a glimpse of me without turning round. Her skinny little arms wrap themselves this way, then that, reversely about her body. Nervously, she crushes her straw hat about her eyes and tilts her head to deepen the shadow, smiling excitedly. As best she can, she hides herself in the full sunlight, her cordy legs writhing beneath a little flower dress that leaves them bare from mid-thigh to ankle. Why has she chosen me for the knife that darts along her smile? Title: Spring Strains. In a tissue-thin monotone of blue-gray buds crowded erect with desire against the sky, tense blue-gray twigs slenderly anchoring them down, drawing them in, two blue-gray birds chasing a third, struggle in circles, angles, swift convergings to a point that bursts instantly, vibrant bowing limbs pulled downward, sucking in the sky that bulges from behind, plastering itself against them in packed rifts, rock blue and dirty orange, but hold hard rigid jointed trees, the blinding and red-edged sun blur, creeping energy, concentrated counterforce, weld sky, buds, trees, rivets them in one puckering hold, sticks through, pulls the whole counterpulling mass upward to the right, locks even the opaque, not yet defined ground in a terrific drag that is loosening the very taproots. On a tissue-thin monotone of blue-gray buds, two blue-gray birds chasing a third at full cry. Now they are flung outward and up, disappearing suddenly. Dedication for a plot of ground. This plot of ground, facing the waters of this inlet, is dedicated the living presence of Emily Dickinson Welcome, who was born in England, married, lost her husband, and with her 5-year-old son sailed for New York in a 2-master, was driven to the Azores, ran adrift on Fire Island Shoal, met her second husband in a Brooklyn boarding house, went with him to Puerto Rico, bore 3 more children, lost her second husband, lived hard for 8 years in St. Thomas, Puerto Rico, San Domingo, followed the oldest son to New York, lost her daughter, lost her baby, seized the 2 boys of the oldest son by the second marriage, mothered them, they being motherless, fought for them, defended herself here against thieves, storms, sun, fire, against flies, against girls that came smelling about, against drought, against weeds, storm tides, neighbors, weasels that stole her chickens, against the weakness of her own hands, against the growing strength of the boys, against wind, against stones, against trespassers, against rents, against her own mind. She grubbed this earth with her own hands, domineered over this grass plot, blackguarded her oldest son into buying it, lived here 15 years, attained a final loneliness. And if you can bring nothing to this place but your carcass, keep out. Love song. I lie here thinking of you. The stain of love is upon the world, yellow, yellow, yellow. It eats into the leaves, smears with saffron the horned branches that lean heavily against a smooth purple sky. There is no light, only a honey-thick stain that drips from leaf to leaf and limb to limb, spoiling the colors of the whole world. You, far off there, under the wine-red selvage of the west. Overture to a Dance of Locomotives. Men with picked voices chant the names of cities in a huge gallery, promises that pull through descending stairways to a deep rumbling. The rubbing feet of those coming to be carried quickens a gray pavement into soft light that rocks to and fro under the domed ceiling, across and across from plain earth-colored walls of bare limestone. Covertly, the hands of a great clock go round and round. Were they to move quickly and at once, the whole secret would be out, and the shuffling of all ants be done forever. A leaning pyramid of sunlight, narrowing out at a high window, moves by the clock. Discordant hands straining out from a center, inevitable postures infinitely repeated, 2, 2, 4, 2, 8. Porters in red hats run on narrow platforms. This way, ma'am. Important not to take the wrong train. Lights from the concrete ceiling hang crooked, but poised horizontal on glittering parallels, the dingy cylinders, packed with a warm glow inviting entry, pull against the hour. But brakes can hold a fixed posture till the whistle. Not 2-8, not 2-4, 2. Gliding windows, colored cooks sweating in a small kitchen, tail lights. In time, 2-4. In time, 2-8. Rivers are tunneled, trestles cross oozy swampland, wheels repeating the same gesture remain relatively stationary, rails forever parallel return on themselves infinitely. The dance is sure. Complaint. They call me and I go. It is a frozen road past midnight, a dust of snow caught in the rigid wheel tracks. The door opens. I smile, enter, and shake off the cold. Here is a great woman on her side in the bed. She is sick, perhaps vomiting, perhaps laboring to give birth to a 10th child. Joy, joy! Night is a room darkened for lovers. Through the jalousies, the sun has sent 1 gold needle. I pick the hair from her eyes and watch her misery with compassion. The cold night. It is cold. The white moon is up among her scattered stars, like the bare thighs of the police sergeant's wife among her 5 children. No answer. Pale shadows lie upon the frosted grass. 1 answer. It is midnight. It is still. and it is cold. White thighs of the sky, a new answer out of the depths of my male belly. In April I shall see again, in April, the round and perfect thighs of the police sergeant's wife, perfect still after many babies. Hoi-yah! Primrose. Yellow, 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 yellow. It is not a color. It is summer. It is the wind on a willow, the lap of waves, the shadow under a bush, a bird, a blue bird, three herons, a dead hawk rotting on a pole. Clear yellow. It is a piece of blue paper in the grass, or a three cluster of green walnuts swaying, children playing croquet, or one boy fishing, a man swinging his pink fists as he walks. It is lady's thumb, forget-me-nots in the ditch, moss under the flange of the car rail, the wavy lines in split rock, a great oak tree. It is a disinclination to be five red petals or a rose. It is a cluster of bird's breast flowers on a stem 6 feet high, four open yellow petals about sepals curled backward into reverse spikes, tufts of purple grass spot the green meadow and clouds the sky. Title, Queen Anne's Lace. Her body is not so white as anemone petals, nor so smooth, nor so remote a thing. It is a field of the wild carrot taking the field by force. The grass does not raise above it. Here is no question of whiteness, white as can be, with a purple mole at the center of each flower. Each flower is a hand's span of her whiteness. Wherever her hand has lain, there is a tiny purple blemish. Each part is a blossom under his touch, to which the fibers of her being stem one by one, each to its end, until the whole field is a white desire, empty, a single stem, a cluster, flower by flower, a pious wish to whiteness gone over, or nothing. To a friend concerning several ladies. You know there is not much that I desire. A few chrysanthemums half lying on the grass, yellow and brown and white, the talk of a few people, the trees, an expanse of dried leaves perhaps with ditches among them. But there comes between me and these things a letter, or even a look well placed, you understand? So that I am confused, twisted four ways and left flat, unable to lift the food to my own mouth. Here is what they say, come and come. And come, and if I do not go, I remain stale to myself, and if I go, I have watched the city from a distance at night, and wondered why I wrote no poem. Come, yes, the city is ablaze for you when you stand and look at it. And they are right. There is no good in the world except out of a woman, and certain women alone for certain things. But what if I arrive like a turtle with my house on my back, or a fish ogling from underwater? It will not do. I must be steaming with love, caught on like a flamingo. For what? To have legs and a silly head and to smell, pah, like a flamingo that soils its own feathers behind? Must I go home filled with a bad poem? And they say, who can answer these things till he has tried? Your eyes are half closed. You're a child. Oh, a sweet one, ready to play. But I'll make a man of you, and with love on your shoulder. And in the marshes, the crickets run on the sunny dike's top and make burrows there. The water reflects the reeds, and the reeds move on their stalks and rattle dryly. Youth and beauty. I bought a dish mop, having no daughter, for they had twisted fine ribbons of shining copper about white twine and made a tousled head of it, fastened it upon a turned ash stick, slender at the neck, straight, tall, when tied upright on the brass wall bracket, to be a light for me, and naked, as a girl should seem to her father. Title, The Thinker. My wife's new pink slippers have gay pom-poms. There is not a spot or a stain on their satin toes or their sides. All night they lie together under her bed's edge, Shivering, I catch sight of them and smile in the morning. Later, I watch them descending the stair, hurrying through the doors and round the table, moving stiffly with a shake of their gay pom-poms. And I talk to them in my secret mind out of pure happiness. The Nightingales. My shoes, as I lean unlacing them, stand out upon flat worsted flowers. Nimbly the shadows of my fingers play unlacing over shoes and flowers. Title: The Widow's Lament in Springtime. Sorrow is my own yard, where the new grass flames as it has flamed often before, but not with the cold fly fire that crows round me this year. 35 years I lived with my husband. The plum tree is white today with masses of flowers. Masses of flowers load the cherry branches and color some branches yellow and some red. But the grief in my heart is stronger than they. For though they were my joy formerly, today I notice them and turn away forgetting. Today my son told me that in the meadows, at the edge of the heavy woods in the distance, he saw trees of white flowers. I feel that I would like to go there and fall into those flowers and sink into the marsh near them. Light-hearted William. Light-hearted William twirled his November mustaches and, half-dressed, looked from the bedroom window upon the spring weather. "Hi-ya!" sighed he gaily, leaning out to see up and down the street where a heavy sunlight lay beyond some blue shadows. Into the room he drew his head again and laughed to himself quietly, twirling his green mustaches. Spring and All. By the road to the contagious hospital, under the surge of the blue, mottled clouds driven from the northeast, a cold wind. Beyond, the waste of broad, muddy fields, brown with dried weeds, standing and fallen. Patches of standing water, the scattering of tall trees. All along the road, the reddish, purplish, forked, upstanding, twiggy stuff of bushes and small trees, with dead, brown leaves under them, leafless vines. Lifeless in appearance, sluggish, dazed spring approaches. They enter the new world naked, cold, uncertain of all, save that they enter. All about them the cold, familiar wind. Now the grass, tomorrow the stiff curl of wild carrot leaf. One by one, objects are defined. It quickens, clarity, outline of leaf. But now the stark dignity of entrance. Still, the profound change has come upon them. Rooted, they grip down and begin to awaken. The Farmer. The farmer, in deep thought, is pacing through the rain among his blank fields, with hands in pockets, in his head the harvest already planted. A cold wind ruffles the water among the browned reeds. On all sides the world rolls coldly away, black orchards darkened by the March clouds, leaving room for thought. Down past the brushwood, bristling by the rain-sluiced wagon road, looms the artist figure of the farmer, composing, antagonist. There's no title to this. The universality of things draws me toward the candy, with melon flowers that open about the edge of refuse, proclaiming without accent the quality of the farmer's shoulders and his daughter's accidental skin, so sweet with clover and the small yellow sankfoil in the parched places. It is this that engages the favorable distortion of eyeglasses that see everything and remain related to mathematics. In the most practical frame of brown celluloid made to represent tortoiseshell, a letter from the man who wants to start a new magazine made of linen, and he owns a typewriter, July 1, 1922. All this is for eyeglasses to discover, but they lie there with the gold earpieces folded down, tranquilly titicaca. Also this, no title. Our orchestra is the Cat's Nuts. Banjo jazz with a nickel-plated amplifier to soothe the savage beast. Get the rhythm. That sheet stuffs a lot of cheese. Man, give me the key and let me loose. I make 'em crazy with my harmony. Shoot it, Jimmy. Nobody, nobody else but me. They can't copy it. To Elsie. The pure products of America go crazy. Mountain folk from Kentucky, or the ribbed north end of Jersey with its isolate lakes and valleys, its deaf-mutes, thieves, old names, and promiscuity between devil-may-care men who have taken to railroading out of sheer lust of adventure, and young slatterns bathed in filth from Monday to Saturday, to be tricked out that night with gauds from imaginations which have no peasant traditions to give them character, but flutter and flaunt sheer rags, succumbing without emotion save dumb terror, under some hedge of chokecherry or viburnum, which they cannot express, unless it be that marriage, perhaps with a dash of Indian blood, will throw up a girl so desolate, so hemmed round with disease or murder, that she'll be rescued by an agent, reared by the state and sent out at 15 to work in some hard-pressed house in the suburbs, some doctor's family, some Elsie. Voluptuous water, expressing with broken brain the truth about us, her great ungainly hips and flopping breasts addressed to cheap jewelry and rich young men with fine eyes, as if the earth under our feet were an excrement of some sky, and we degraded prisoners destined to hunger until we eat filth, while the imagination strains after deer going by fields of goldenrod in the stifling heat of September. Somehow it seems to destroy us. It is only an isolate flex that something is given off. No one to witness and adjust. No one to drive the car. The Red Wheelbarrow. So much depends upon a red wheelbarrow glazed with rainwater beside the white chickens. To this no title. The veritable night of wires and stars, the moon is in the oak tree's crotch, and sleepers in the windows cough athwart the round and pointed leaves, and insects sing while on the grass the whitish moonlight tearfully assumes the attitudes of afternoon. But it is real where peaches hang, recalling death's long-promised symphony, whose tuneful wood and stringish undergrowth are ghosts existing without being, save to come with juice and pulp to assuage the hungers which the night reveals, so that now at last the truth's aglow, with devilish peace forestalling day, which dawns tomorrow with dreadful reds the heart to predicate with mists that loved the ocean and the fields. Thus moonlight is the perfect human touch. Title, It Is a Living Carl. It is a living Carl, a trouble, archaically fettered to produce a pluribus unum, an island in the sea, a capital surmounted by armed liberty, painting, sculpture straddled by a dome 8 million pounds in weight, iron plates constructed to expand and contract with variations of temperature, the folding and unfolding of a lily, and Congress authorized. And the commission was entrusted, a sculptured group, Mars in Roman mail, placing a wreath of laurel on the brow of Washington, Commerce, Minerva, Thomas Jefferson, John Hancock at the table, Mrs. Mott presenting Indian burning arrows to Generals Marion and Lee to fire her mansion and dislodge the British. This scaleless jumble is superb and accurate in its expression of the thing they would destroy. Baptism of Pocahontas with a little card hanging under it to tell the persons in the picture. It climbs. It is George Shoop of Idaho. It wears a beard. It fetches naked Indian women from a river. Trumbull, Varnum, Henderson, Francis Willard's corset is absurd. Banks, white Columbus stretched in bed. Men felling trees. The Honorable Michael C. Kerr, one-time Speaker of the House of Representatives. Perry in a rowboat on Lake Erie, changing ships. The dead among the wreckage, sickly green. The Bull. It is in captivity, ringed, haltered, chained to a drag, the bull is godlike. Unlike the cows, he lives alone, nozzles the sweet grass gingerly to pass the time away. He kneels, lies down, and stretching out a foreleg, licks himself about the hoof, then stays with half-closed eyes, Olympian commentary on the bright passage of days. The round sun smooths his lacquer through the glossy pine trees, his substance hard as ivory or glass through which the wind yet plays. Milkless, he nods, the hair between his horns and eyes matted with hyacinthine curls. The Botticellian trees. The alphabet of the trees is fading in the song of the leaves, the crossing bars of the thin letters that spelled winter and the cold have been illumined with pointed green by the rain and sun. The strict, simple principles of straight branches are being modified by pinched-out ifs of color, devout conditions, the smiles of love, until the stripped sentences move as a woman's limbs under cloth, and praise from secrecy with hot ardor love's ascendancy. In summer the song sings itself above the muffled words. Flowers by the sea. When, over the flowery, sharp pasture's edge, unseen, the salt ocean lifts its form, chicory and daisies, tied, released, seem hardly flowers alone, but color and the movement, or the shape, perhaps, of restlessness, whereas the sea is circled and sways peacefully upon its plant-like stem. The yachts. The yachts contend in a sea which the land partly encloses, shielding them from the too heavy blows of an ungoverned ocean, which, when it chooses, tortures the biggest hulls the best man knows to pit against its beatings and sinks them pitilessly. Moth-like in mists, scintillant in the minute brilliance of cloudless days, with broad-bellying sails, they glide to the wind, tossing green water from their sharp prows, while over them the crew crawls ant-like, solicitously grooming them, releasing, making fast, as they turn, lean far over, and having caught the wind again, side by side, head for the mark. In a well-guarded arena of open water, surrounded by lesser and greater craft, which, sycophant, lumbering and flittering follow them, they appear youthful, rare as the light of a happy eye, live with the grace of all that in the mind is feckless, free, and naturally to be desired. Now the sea which holds them is moody, lapping their glossy sides as if feeling for some slightest flaw, but fails completely. Today no race. Then the wind comes again. The yachts move, jockeying for a start. The signal is set, and they are off. Now the waves strike at them, but they are too well made. They slip through, though they take in canvas. Arms with hands grasping seek to clutch at the prows. Bodies thrown recklessly in the way are cut aside. It is a sea of faces about them in agony, in despair, until the horror of the race dawns staggering the mind, the whole sea become an entanglement of watery bodies, lost to the world, bearing what they cannot hold, broken, beaten, desolate, reaching from the dead to be taken up. They cry out, failing, failing, their cries rising in waves still as the skillful yachts pass over. The term. A rumpled sheet of brown paper about the length and apparent bulk of a man was rolling with the wind slowly over and over in the street as a car drove down upon it and crushed it to the ground. Unlike a man, it rose again, rolling with the wind over and over to be as it was before. These poems are from the new book, The Wedge. A sort of a song. Let the snake wait under his weed, and the writing be of words, slow and quick, sharp to strike, quiet to wait, sleepless. Through metaphor to reconcile the people and the stones, compose, no ideas but in things, invent. Saxifrage is my flower that splits the rocks. The dance. In Bruegel's great picture, The Kermesse, the dancers go round. They go round and around. The squeal and the blare and the tweedle of bagpipes, of bugle and fiddles, tipping their bellies round as the thick-sided glasses whose wash they impound, their hips and their bellies off balance to turn them. Kicking and rolling about the fair grounds, swinging their butts, those shanks must be sound to bear up under such rollicking measures, prance as they dance in Bruegel's great picture, The Kermesse. Burning the Christmas greens. Their time passed, pulled down, cracked, and flung to the fire, go up in a roar. All recognition lost, burnt clean, clean in the flame. The green dispersed, a living red, flame red, red as blood, wakes on the ash, and ebbs to a steady burning, the rekindled bed become a landscape of flame. At the winter's midnight, we went to the trees, the coarse holly, the balsam, and the hemlock for their green. At the thick of the dark, the moment of the cold's deepest plunge, we brought branches cut from green trees to fill our need, and over doorways, about paper Christmas bells covered with tin foil and fastened by red ribbons, we stuck the green prongs. In the windows hung woven wreaths, and about pictures the living green. On the mantel we built a green forest, and among those hemlock sprays put a herd of small white deer, as if they were walking there. All this, and it seemed gentle and good to us. Their time passed, relief, the room bare. We stuffed the dead grate with them upon the half-burnt-out log's smoldering eye, opening red and closing under them, and we stood there looking down. Green is a solace, a promise of peace, a fort against the cold, though we did not say so, a challenge above the snow's hard shell. Green, we might have said, that where small birds hide and dodge and lift their plaintive rallying cries, blocks for them and knocks down the unseeing bullets of the storm. Green spruce boughs pulled down by a weight of snow, transformed. Violence leaped and appeared, recreant, roared to life as the flames rose through and our eyes recoiled from it. In the jagged flames, green to red, instant and alive, green, those sure abutments, gone, lost to mind, and quick in the contracting tunnel of the grate appeared a world, black mountains, black and red, as yet uncolored, and white ash, an infant landscape of shimmering ash and flame, and we, in that instant, lost, breathless to be witnesses, as if we stood ourselves, refreshed among the shining fauna of that fire. Title, in sisterly fashion. The ugly woman clutched her lover round the neck. Her skin was white as snow as she wept softly to herself, knowing her lack of beauty like the sting of death, by which she praised in sisterly fashion your fitted limbs, your honeyed breath. The world narrowed to a point. Liquor and love, when the mind is dull, focus the wit on the world of form. The eye awakes, perfumes are defined, inflections ride the quick ear. Liquor and love, rescue the cloudy sense, banish its despair, give it a home. The Hounded Lovers. Where shall we go? Where shall we go who are in love? Juliet went to Friar Lawrence's cell, but we have no rest. Rainwater lies on the hard ground, reflecting the morning sky. But where shall we go? We cannot resolve ourselves into a dew nor sink into the earth. Shall we postpone it to eternity? The dry heads of the goldenrod turn to stiff ghosts, jerk at their stalks, signaling grave warning. Where shall we go? The movement of benediction does not turn back the cold wind. the cure. Sometimes I end the others, fear them a little too if they write well. For when I cannot write, I'm a sick man and want to die. The cause is plain, but they have no access to my sources. Let them write then as they may, and perfect it as they can. They will never come to the secret of that form internit with the unfathomable ground where we walk daily, and from which, among the rest, you have sprung and opened flower-like to my hand. The rose. The stillness of the rose in time of war reminds me of the long sleep just begun of that sparrow, his head pillowed unruffed and unalarmed upon the polished pavement, or of voluptuous hours with some breathless book, when stillness was an eternity long since begun. Perfection. Oh, lovely apple, beautifully and completely rotten. Hardly a contour marred, perhaps a little shriveled at the top, but that aside, perfect in every detail. Oh, lovely apple, what a deep and suffusing brown mantles that unspoiled surface. No one has moved you since I placed you on the porch rail a month ago to ripen. No one, no one. The last turn. Then see it, in distressing detail, from behind a red light at 53rd and 8th of a November evening, the jazz of the cross lights echoing the crazy weave of the breaking mind, splash of a half-purple, half-naked woman's body whose jeweled guts the cars drag up and down. No house but has its brains blown off by the dark, nothing recognizable. The whole one jittering direction, made of all directions, spelling the inexplicable. Pigment upon flesh, and flesh the pigment. The genius of a world against which rages the fury of our concepts, artless but supreme. The aftermath. The winner! Pure as snow, courageous as the wind, strong as a tree, deceptive as the moon. All that is the country fitted into you, for you were born there. Now it is rewarding you for the unswerving mind, curious as a fox, which fox-like escaped breathless to its hole. They say you have grown thinner, and that there is a girl now to add to the blue-eyed boy. Good! The air of the uplands is stimulating. The yellow chimney. There is a plume of flesh-pale smoke upon the blue sky. The silver rings that strap the yellow brick stack at wide intervals shine in this amber light. Not of the sun, not of the pale sun, but his born brother, the declining season. I'm going to read that again. The yellow chimney. There is a plume of flesh-pale smoke upon the blue sky. The silver rings that strap the yellow brick stack at wide intervals shine in this amber light. Not of the sun, not of the pale sun, but his born brother, the declining season. Raleigh was right. We cannot go to the country, for the country will bring us no peace. What can the small violets tell us that grow on furry stems in the long grass among lance-shaped leaves? Though you praise us and call to mind the poets who sung of our loveliness, it was long ago, when country people would plow and sow with flowering minds and pockets at ease, if ever this were true. Not now. Love itself a flower with roots in a parched ground. Empty pockets make empty heads. Cure it if you can, but do not believe that we can live today in the country. For the country will bring us no peace. A Night in June. I was a young man then, full of information and tenderness. It was her first baby. She lived just around the corner from her present abode, one room over a small general store kept by an old man. It was a difficult forceps delivery, and I lost the child, to my disgust. Though without nurse, anesthetist, or even enough hot water in the place, I shouldn't have been overmuch blamed. I must have been fairly able not to have done worse. But I won a friend, and I found another to admire, a sort of love for the woman. She was slightly older than her husband, the heavy-looking Italian boy. Both were short, a peasant woman who could scarcely talk a word of English, being recently come from the other side, a woman of great simplicity of character, docility, patience, with a fine direct look in her gray eyes, and courageous, devoted to her instincts and convictions and to me. Sometimes she'd cry out at her husband, as I got to know her later, with some high-pitched animalistic sound, when he would say something to her in Italian that I couldn't understand, and I knew that he was holding out for me, and I knew that she was holding out for me. Usually, though, she said very little, looking me straight in the eye with a smile, her voice pleasant and candid, though I could scarcely understand her few broken words. Her sentences were seldom more than three or four words long. She always acted as though I must naturally know what was in her mind, and her smile, with a shrug, always won me. Apart from the second child, born a year after the first, during the absence of the family from town for a short time, I had delivered Angelina of all her children. This one would make my eighth attendance on her ninth labor. 3 a.m., June the 10th, I noticed the calendar as I flashed on the light in my office to pick up my satchel, the same, by the way, my uncle had given me when I graduated from medical school. One gets not to deliver women at home nowadays. The hospital is the place for it. The equipment is far better. Smiling, I picked up the relic from where I had tossed it 2 or 3 years before under a table in my small laboratory, hoping never to have to use it again. In it I found a brand new hypodermic syringe with the manufacturer's name still shining with black enamel on the barrel. Also a pair of curved scissors I had been looking for the last 3 years, thinking someone had stolen them. I dusted off the top of the Lysol bottle when I took it from the shelf, and quickly checking on the rest of my necessities, I went off without coat or tie, wearing the same shirt I had had on during the day preceding, soiled, but better so. It was a beautiful June night. The lighted clock in the tower over the factory said 3:20. The clock in the facade of the trust company across the track said it also. Paralleling the railroad, I recognized the squat figure of the husband returning home ahead of me, whistling as he walked. I put my hand out of the car in sign of recognition and kept on, rounding the final triangular block a little way ahead, to bring my car into the right in front of the woman's house for parking. The husband came up as I was trying to decide which of the two steep cobbled entryways to take. "Got you up early," he said. "Where you been?" his sister said to him when we had got into the house from the rear. "I went down to the police to telephone," he said. "That's the surest way." "I told you to go next door, you dope. What did you go way down there for, leaving me here alone?" "Well, I don't want to wake anybody up." "I got two calls," I broke in. "Yes, he went away and left me alone. I got scared, so I waked him up anyway to call you." The kitchen where we stood was lighted by a somewhat damaged Wells Black Mantle gaslight. Everything was quiet. The husband took off his cap and sat along the wall. I put my satchel on the tubs and began to take things out. There was just one sterile umbilical tie left, two really in the same envelope as always for possible twins. But that detail aside, everything was ample and in order. I complimented myself. Even the Argerol was there in tablet form, ensuring the full potency of a fresh solution. Nothing so satisfying as a kit of any sort, prepared and in order, even when picked up in an emergency after an interval of years. I selected out two artery clamps and two scissors. One thing, there'd be no need of sutures afterward in this case. "You want a hot bottle?" "Not yet," I said. "Might as well take off my shirt, though," which I did, throwing it on a kitchen chair and donning the usual light rubber apron. "I'm sorry we ain't got no light in here. The electricity is turned off. Do you think you can see with a candle?" "Sure, why not?" But it was very dark in the room where the woman lay on a low double bed. A 3-year-old boy was asleep on the sheet beside her. She wore an abbreviated nightgown to her hips. Her short, thick legs had, as I knew, bunches of large varicose veins upon them like vines. Everything was clean and in order. The sister-in-law held the candle. Few words were spoken. I made the examination and found the head high, but the cervix fully dilated. Oh, yeah. It often happens in women who have had many children, pendulous abdomen, lack of muscular power resulting in a slight misdirection of the forces of labor, and the thing may go on for days. When I finished, Angelina got up and sat on the edge of the bed. I went back to the kitchen, the candle following me, leaving the room dark again. Do you need it any more? The sister-in-law said, I'll put it out. Then the husband spoke up. Ain't you got but that one candle? No, said the sister. Why didn't you get some at the store when you woke me up? Use your head. The woman had the candle in a holder on the cold coal range. She leaned over to blow it out, but misdirected her aim. She got to blow three times to do it. Three or four times. What's the matter, said her brother. Getting weak? Old age counts. Eh, Doc? He said, and got up finally to go out. We could hear an engineer signaling outside in the still night with short, quick blast of his whistle, very staccato. Not, I suppose, to make any greater disturbance than necessary with people sleeping all about. Later on, the freights began to roar past, shaking the whole house. She doesn't seem to be having many strong pains, I said to my companion in the kitchen, but there wasn't a sound from the labor room and hadn't been for the past half hour. She don't want to make no noise. Wake the kids. How old is the oldest now, I asked. He's 16. The girl would have been 18 this year, you know, the one you took from her. Where are they all? In there, with a nod of the head toward the other room of the apartment, such as it was, the first floor of an old two-story house, the whole thing perhaps 25 feet each way. I sat in a straight chair by the kitchen table, my right arm bare to the shoulder, resting on the worn oilcloth. She says she wants an enema, said the woman. Okay, but I don't know how to give it to her. You ain't got a bedpan or nothing. I don't want to get the bed all wet. Has she had a movement today? Yeah, but she thinks an enema will help her. Well, have you got a bag? Yeah, she says there's one here somewhere. Get it. She's got a chamber pot here, hasn't she? Sure. So the woman got the equipment, a blue rubber douche bag, the rubber of it feeling rather stiff to the touch. She laid it on the stove in its open box and looked at it, holding her hands out helplessly. I'm afraid, she said. All right, you hold the candle. Mix up a little warm soapy water. We'll need some Vaseline. The woman called out to us where to find it, having overheard our conversation. Lift up till I put these newspapers under you, said my assistant. I don't want to wet the bed. That's nothing, Angelina answered, smiling, but she raised her buttocks high so we could fix her. Returning 10 minutes later to my chair, I saw the woman taking the pot out through the kitchen and upstairs to empty it. I crossed my legs, crossed my bare arms in my lap also, and let my head fall forward. I must have slept, for when I opened my eyes again, both my legs and my arms were somewhat numb. I felt deliciously relaxed, though, somewhat bewildered. I must have snored, waking myself with a start. Everything was quiet as before. The peace of the room was unchanged. Delicious. I heard the woman and her attendant making some sounds in the next room and went in. Examining her, I found things unchanged. It was about 4:30. What to do? Do you mind if I give you the needle? I asked her gently. We've been through this many times before. She shrugged her shoulders as much as to say, it's up to you. So I gave her a few minims of pituitrin to intensify the strength of the pains. I was cautious since the practice is not without danger. It is possible to get a ruptured uterus where the muscle has been stretched by many pregnancies if one does not know what he's doing. Then I returned to the kitchen to wait once more. This time I took out the obstetric gown I'd brought with me. It was in a roll that had come from the satchel, and covering it with my shirt to make a better surface and a little more bulk, I placed it on the edge of the table and, leaning forward, laid my face sidewise upon it, my arms reaching out on the table before me, my nose and my mouth at the table edge between my arms. I could breathe freely. It was a pleasant position, and as I lay there content, I thought, as I often do, of what painting it was in which I had seen men sleeping that way. Then I fell asleep, and in my half-sleep began to argue with myself of some imaginary power of science and humanity. Our exaggerated ways will have to pull in their horns, I said. We've learned from one teacher and neglected another. Now that I'm older, I'm finding the older school. The pituitary extract and other simple devices represent science. Science, I dreamed, has crowded the stage more than is necessary. The process of selection will simplify the application. It touches us too crudely now. All newness is overcomplex. I couldn't tell whether I was asleep or awake. But without science, without pituitrin, I'd be here till noon, or maybe, what? Some others wouldn't wait so long, but rush at her now. A carefully guarded shot of pituitrin ought to save her at least much exhaustion, if not more. But I don't want to have anything happen to her. Now when I lifted my head, there was beginning to be a little light outside. The woman was quiet, no progress. This time I increased the dose of pituitrin. She had stronger pains, but without effect. Maybe I'd better give you a still larger dose, I said. She made no demur. Well, let me see if I can help you first. I sat on the edge of the bed while the sister-in-law held the candle again, glancing at the window where the daylight was growing. With my left hand steering the child's head, I used my ungloved right hand outside on her bare belly to press upon the fundus. The woman and I then got to work. Her two hands grabbed me at first a little timidly about the right wrist and forearm. Go ahead, I said. Pull hard. I welcomed the feeling of her hands and the strong pull. It quieted me in the way the whole house had quieted me all night. This woman in her present condition would have seemed repulsive to me 10 years ago. Now, poor soul, I see her to be as clean as a cow, the calves. The flesh of my arm lay against the flesh of her knee gratefully. It was I who was being comforted and soothed. Finally, the head began to move. I wasn't sorry, thinking perhaps I'd have to do something radical before long. We kept at it till the head was born, and I could leave her for a moment to put on my other glove. It was almost light now. What time is it? I asked the other woman. 6 o'clock, she said. Just after I had tied the cord, cut it, and lifted the baby, a girl, to hand it to the woman, I saw the mother clutch herself suddenly between her thighs and give a cry. I was startled. The other woman turned with a flash and shouted, "Get out of here, you damn kids! I'll slap your damn faces for you!" And the door through which a head appeared was pulled closed. The 3-year-old on the bed beside the mother stirred when the baby cried, at first shrilly, but had not awakened. Oh, yes, the drops in the baby's eyes. No need. She's as clean as a beast. How do I know? Medical discipline says every case must have drops in the eyes. No chance of gonorrhea, though, but do it. I heard her husband come into the kitchen now, so we gave him the afterbirth and a newspaper to bury. "Keep them damn kids out of here," his sister told him. "Lock that door." Of course, there was no lock on it. "How do you feel now?" I asked the woman after everything had been cleaned up. "All right," she said, with a peculiar turn of her head and smile by which I knew her. "How many is that?" I asked the other woman. 5 boys and 3 girls, she said. "I've forgotten how to fix a baby," she went on. "How will I do it? Put a little boric acid on the belly button to help dry it up?"